Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's open forum. You're welcome to call with whatever question you've got for Jimmy. 888-318-7884-888-31-TRUTH. Jimmy, I want to say a special thank you for you to be here because I know this is your fifth hour of radio today. So
it is, thanks. Yeah.
Yeah, we did some hours earlier for future airing, and you also get requests to do interviews, and so I know you were doing an interview with somebody.
This is a 5-hour radio day for me. Yep.
But you love doing radio, though. You're not one of those people who minds it.
No. I've done 4-hour live streams by myself.
Have you really?
No one else there.
Oh, you do your Thanksgiving, your big Thanksgiving.
Christmas.
Oh, Christmas. That's when you do it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you enjoy it. It's fun today.
Yeah, it's fun. It's stimulating.
Well, good. We got a lot of fun and stimulating stuff to go. It's so funny to me that I said Framley before, and you and Darren
you
heard
said
it.
Framley.
Framley? Is that what it was?
Yeah.
And it's funny because usually when you make an error like that, you hear it. I didn't hear it at all. Like, you guys actually surprised me when you said, you just said Framley. I didn't realize that I had done it. So, getting old. 888. Ruh-roh. Ruh-roh. I need it. Oh, and I just took, we just took the break and I didn't even get a Scooby snack from anybody after all that. I tell you what, also visiting the studio with our good friend Penelope is our friend Yolanda. And Yolanda got a text question from her nephew, Robert, from Woodstock, Canada. And he wanted me to ask you this question, Jimmy.
Okay.
Robert asks, can and should the filioque be removed now? Or is it still important to keep it?
Well, it's going to depend on the answer to the question, removed from what?
Oh.
And in Eastern Catholic rites that you know, for example, use Greek as their language of the creed, not only should it be removed, but it has been removed. And the Vatican wanted it removed because the Greek didn't fully correspond, in part because the Greek, if I remember correctly, didn't fully correspond to the meaning in Latin. And this was a sensitive issue. It was causing friction, including between Catholics and, for example, Eastern Orthodox. And the Catholic Church is trying to promote Christian unity and hopefully eventual reconciliation with the Orthodox, and continuing to have something like that in liturgy that Eastern Catholics were saying would not foster that goal. And so during the reign of John Paul II, it was decided that this should be omitted from the creed when people are saying it in Greek.
Oh.
And so I think it's fine for it to be removed from that. Now the question is, well, what about in other parts of the Latin Rite where the filioque, and we should explain what that is for people who may not know. Filius is Latin for son. Quae is Latin for and. But unlike the word et, which also means and, et goes in front of the noun it modifies, and quae goes afterwards. So filioque means and the son, even though they put the and after the word son. And this is a clause in the Nicene Creed where originally what the Nicene Creed said was that the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father. And then in the Middle Ages, in Latin contexts, they added and the Son. And this was not made in non-Latin speaking context. So it didn't get added. It wasn't a universal thing in the church that everybody was saying this, but it has been infallibly defined that this is true. So even though there are a lot of things that have been infallibly defined that we don't say as part of the creed. So it's definitely true, but you don't have to say it as part of the creed if you're in an Eastern, like a Greek Catholic church. And so the compromise was, in Greek, it doesn't get said these days, but in Latin and languages that translate their liturgy from the Latin, so English, it does get said. And I don't think it would be good to remove it in those contexts. At least I can see a strong argument that it shouldn't be removed in those contexts, because what if you did remove it? You know, what if you did take it out of the creed for everybody, it would cause a lot of confusion. You know, Latin Catholics have been saying "and the Son" for centuries now. And you can imagine how this would get reported in the press. It would not get reported as Catholic Church de-emphasizes a teaching that is infallibly taught by no longer mentioning it in the creed. It would get reported as Catholic Church changes church teaching about the Holy Spirit. And that would cause a ton of confusion. So I think the compromise they've worked out, where it doesn't get said in various Eastern contexts, but it does get said in a Latin context, I think that actually works pretty well. It may not, there are still issues to work through as part of church reconciliation, but I think that it removes a stumbling block and still upholds the truth, the compromise that they found.
Well, Robert, thank you for the question. And Yolanda, thank you very much for bringing it to us. We'll go now to Lindsay in Lincoln, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Lindsay, thank you very much for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, good evening, gentlemen. My question is, if you have a friend or family member who is a confirmed Catholic but is deciding to get married, is a non-practicing Catholic anymore, fallen away, deciding to get married outside of the Catholic Church, is it acceptable to attend that wedding, and does your answer change if you are a parent or godparent and or the confirmation sponsor for that person?
Okay, so now I think there's a strong case that this law needs to be changed, but and there are various scholars of canon law who would agree that there is a strong case this law needs to be changed. But the way the law is written now, everyone who is a baptized, who has been baptized or received into the Catholic Church, either needs to observe the Catholic form of marriage, which means getting married in a Catholic church effectively, or they need to be in some special situation, like having a dispensation from form so that they can get married in a different church. Or it's an emergency circumstance where they're stranded on an island and a priest is not going to be available for a month, and so they go ahead and get married on the island. You know, there are exceptions. But unless those exceptions apply, the marriage is not going to be valid if it's between a Catholic and, for example, a Protestant or a non-Catholic. It's different if it's Eastern Orthodox. It actually, the marriage would be valid if they're marrying, if they get married in an Eastern Orthodox church. They're not supposed to do that without a dispensation, but it would be valid. But if they're marrying a Protestant or a non-Christian, the way the law is written, the marriage would not be valid. And so that gets us to the question of, can you attend a marriage that you know is going to be invalid? Well, the code doesn't address this directly. What the code does say, though, is that Catholics need to maintain communion with the church, even in their own patterns of personal behavior. And it looks like, so effectively what that does is it kicks us into the realm of moral theology. And we need to ask the moral theological question, would this be moral to attend such a marriage, since the church doesn't have a direct rule about this? Well, if you show up at a marriage knowing it's going to be invalid and you don't say anything else, your presence is going to send the message that you think the marriage is valid. Otherwise, why would you be showing up? You know, when you show up at a normal marriage, you're presuming these two people really are getting married. And so even if you don't say anything, just by being physically present at it, you could be unintentionally lying to the people and telling them you think their marriage is valid when really you don't think their marriage is valid. So a standard piece of advice would be not to attend such marriages. Now, there are then questions about, could you attend the marriage but let the bride and groom know that you don't think this is a valid marriage, but you're here out of respect and care for them? Well, the situation's muddier. Again, the church doesn't have a teaching on this or a rule about this. So we have to kind of do our best with moral theology to figure out what's the best thing to do in this situation. And there are going to be different opinions on that. Some individuals would say, well, you know, you could, for purposes of maintaining family harmony or maintaining a relationship that you could later use if you're, say, their godparent to help bring them back to the church, you could go. On the other hand, you can argue that actually telling them you're not going and why would send a stronger message of, look, you need to take the church's teaching on this seriously. You either need to get married in the Catholic Church or you need to get a dispensation so you can get married in another church, or it's not going to be valid. And I'm going to be honest with you because I'm your godparent or your confirmation sponsor or whatever. And I want to be part of my job is to help you live the Christian faith. And if I just showed up at this, even kind of under protest, it would send the signal to you that this really isn't that important. Because otherwise, why am I here? If this is important, why am I here? And so I want to make sure you understand this is important. And so that's why, as much as I love you and care for you and want to help you out, that's why I can't attend this event. But, you know, I'm always here to help you in any way that I can, and I hope that, you know, I hope you're able to understand my position and that this doesn't put a barrier between us. So it's a tricky situation, but that's what I can tell you about the different options and opinions that people would have in this area.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Lindsay, no problem. Thank you very much for the call. That does bring us to the first break this hour. We'll take a break, right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host of Register Radio with Matthew Bunsen. Join us every week as we talk with the Register's expert writers and editors about the news you need to know and offer authentic Catholic insights on the important stories that impact your life. Register Radio, every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern and Sunday at 11 a.m. Eastern here on EWTN Global Catholic Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and we're having a lot of fun doing Open Forum. Jimmy Akin here. Lots of great calls for an August afternoon. You're welcome to bring your call if you've got a question. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Tomorrow on Jimmy's podcast, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, which, by the way, is one of the most popular documentary podcasts in the world. Tomorrow it'll be the secrets of Masonry or Freemasonry. How do I say it?
Yep. Freemasonry. Either one. They mean the same thing.
Oh, all right. So check it out. I was going to say, nope, not JimmyAkin.com. There's a lot of good stuff there. But
oh, you could go to JimmyAkin.com because we cross-posted there.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, well, there's a good little bit of information.
You can also go to my YouTube channel for the video version, which is youtube.com/JimmyAkin. And you could go to its homepage, mysterious.fm, just like FM radio, mysterious.fm. Or you could go to Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or any of those things.
So if that's not enough options for you, I don't know. I just don't know if there's anything more we can do. Let's go up to Carlos in Canada. Listening on Catholic.com. That's our website, Catholic.com. Carlos, thanks for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes, thank you. So, Jimmy, I had a question regarding the self-defense that the Catholic Church teaches. Mm-hmm. I've heard many people say this means that citizens have like a right to bear arms because this is a great duty. But on the other hand, I see that Pope Francis and even the U.S. bishops have been calling for more gun control, which seems to go against that. So I'm unsure what's the right way here, or what's the church stance on this important issue? Because this, they have even called it being a pro-life issue now, just the same as abortion, basically.
Okay.
Well, that's clearly not the case. I mean, self-defense does engage life issues, but that doesn't make it the same as abortion. Because if you're defending yourself as an aggressor, against an aggressor, then that's in a different category than attacking an innocent person where you're the aggressor. And so abortion involves attacking an innocent person, the unborn child, and that's aggression against the unborn child. Whereas defending yourself against someone who's attacking you is in a different moral category. It's not wrong to defend yourself. And the church acknowledges that, you know, if it's a choice between your life and the life of the attacker, you can take human life in order to defend yourself or defend others. So they're, even though they both may involve life issues, they are not the same life issue. In terms of parsing various statements, whether it's by bishops, conferences, or popes, it's important to be aware that not everything that gets reported in a bishop's name or a pope's name is actually what they said. You frequently find misreporting going on in the media where it'll be kind of in the ballpark of what they said, but they've dropped out important qualifiers. Or even if it is exactly what they said, even if you have a direct quote with enough context to understand the meaning of the quote correctly, it doesn't mean it's a magisterial teaching. If the Pope says chocolate ice cream is the best, that doesn't make it a church teaching. So in addition to determining what was actually said, you have to look at what level of authority does it have? What level of authority has a member or members of the magisterium invested it with? And thus far, I am unaware of any statement by either the U.S. bishops or any other group of bishops or any of the recent popes, including Pope Francis, that addresses the question of can you own a gun in order to protect yourself if you're in a dangerous environment. What I am aware of are some statements that are advisory rather than church teaching documents that condemn, for example, weapons trafficking. Weapons trafficking is a serious issue, and we don't want weapons pouring into, you know, various zones of the world where they're going to make the situation more dangerous and more unstable. So talking about weapons trafficking and arms control is one thing, but that's different than saying you are not able morally to own a gun or other weapon, like a knife, to defend yourself. And so I'm simply unaware of anything that addresses that issue one way or the other. And so I don't see these as fundamentally in opposition. Just like if you're at home and a home invader breaks in and is trying to kill you, and the only weapon you've got available is yourself. And if you can do that, then a gun is just a knife that works at a distance. It does the same thing. It punctures the other person. It just does so using a bullet that detaches from the gun. And so you can use it to defend yourself even more safely than using a knife to defend yourself. But there's no fundamental moral distinction. They're both deadly weapons. And if one of them is legitimate to use in self-defense, then the other is going to be legitimate to use in self-defense as well.
Carlos, does that address what you were thinking about?
Yes, just wanted to clarify that, yes, U.S. bishops have called for more gun control. And
okay, Carlos, that's ambiguous. Now, number one, I can't just take your word on that because I haven't seen the documents. I need to see the documents to assess what they say. You may have heard in the media that they have, quote unquote, called for more gun control, but that doesn't tell me that they've said it's immoral to own a gun to defend yourself. Gun control can take a bunch of different forms. And just because you hear a press account saying they have called for more gun control doesn't tell me what they've actually called for. There are a bunch of different ways of understanding that, including the arms trafficking which I know they've addressed. I'm aware of where they've addressed arms trafficking, but that's not the same as private gun ownership for purposes of hunting or self-defense or target shooting. And so it also does not tell me that they've said this in a magisterial document as opposed to some other kind of document, because they issue lots of other kind of documents. Now, if you want to send me a primary source to look at, my email is jimmy@catholic.com, and I'm happy to look at the sources. But I can't let a statement just assuring us of this go unchallenged, because I don't know that to be the case. And I have a responsibility to the listening audience to let them know what the limits of my knowledge are. And I can't just accept it that something is the case that seems at variance with the history on this issue.
Carlos is going to leave it there because we do have full lines today. Thank you very much for the call and for the question. I'm going to go to an anonymous caller now in Oregon, watching on YouTube. Anonymous, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, guys. I just want to say thank you guys so much. I'm a Catholic convert myself, and you guys played a pretty big part in that. So well, thank you, guys.
Oh, thank you very much for sharing that with us.
Absolutely. So I kind of have a crazy story, so I won't go long, but I need...
Well, you say that now.
I just need some guidance because, you know, I come from a Protestant background, a Pentecostal-type background, and really have saw the manifestations of the Holy Spirit, really, and I come from that kind of perspective. So, but one thing's different. I'm a military veteran, but I came home with a lot of problems like PTSD and severe anxiety disorders.
Oh, no.
And so I was on medication pretty much my whole life, but I would also use cannabis. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I use probably since I was like 15 years old. And it's never did the things that everybody else happens to them. It just kind of just makes me feel like a normal person. Mm-hmm. And so as an adult now, you know, I'm almost in my 40s, and like there's still a stigma behind it. Like, I'm a medical marijuana patient, and, mm-hmm. you know, I just have all this trauma, and it helps me become, you know, closer to God. And just it's kind of hard to talk about that because, you know, it's like so stigmatized. But I literally talk to God, and I like read the Bible like while I'm using cannabis. And
so you want to know
something that's been so helpful
from
what's
Jimmy?
Your question for me.
So, like, two things, like, what is the church teaching of it? And then, two, like, if it is something that's permitted, like, I've had priests tell me that it is, how am I supposed to live a life, like, as a Catholic? Because, I mean, I go to Mass, like twice a week and, like, confession once a week, dude. Like,
okay.
This is my whole life, you know?
Okay, well, so the church doesn't have a teaching about medical marijuana, there's nothing magical about, you know, the THC or the CBD that's in marijuana. They're just chemical substances, and they have different effects on biological systems, including human beings. So the question is, if you're taking medical marijuana or some marijuana derivative like CBD oil, is it giving you a benefit? And does that benefit outweigh any negative consequences that it also has? Because typically when you introduce a chemical into your body, it has both positive and negative consequences, depending in particular on the dosage you receive. I mean, water is a good thing. Water, H2O, is a chemical that is necessary for human life. But if you drink too much water, it's going to raise your blood pressure. And if you drink even more water, you're going to get water toxicity and can die. So you have to look at the situation of what is the chemical doing, and do the benefits outweigh the detriments? In the case of medical marijuana, if you have post-traumatic stress disorder or anxiety disorders that it will address, then it's potentially legitimate to use, which is why it's legal in various places. You also want to say, well, is there another solution that might be better? Or is it going to have long-term consequences that would outweigh the effects it's having right now? So you need to do it in an informed way. But if the best solution is to use it, at least for now, then there's nothing immoral about that. Now, if you're using it too much so that you lose your moral faculties and start committing mortal sins, then you have achieved what Aquinas would call a state of perfect intoxication. And perfect intoxication, knowingly and deliberately entering a state where you just lose your moral faculties, that would be a mortal sin. And that wouldn't be legitimate. But as if you're using it, any chemical, in a moderate way that provides benefits that outweigh the detriments, then that's morally legitimate in principle. So if you've been prescribed its use and it's genuinely having benefits for you that outweigh the detriments, then I wouldn't worry about it beyond that. I would monitor the situation, make sure you're using it responsibly, and periodically do a check to see, is there something else that I should use that's come along now that would be even better for me? But it wouldn't be immoral in principle to use it to actually treat a condition like this.
Anonymous, thank you very, very much for the call. Thank you for your service to our country. And I'm very sorry to hear about the trauma. I hope you'll call again sometime. Oh, Jimmy, you were going
to
say something?
I want to ask the listeners to pray for Anonymous and everyone in similar situations.
We got to go for a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Is relativism dead? It sure seems dead. Each day, new moral demands are made and they are presented to us as absolutes. Everything from transgender ideology to physician-assisted suicide is presented as a moral good that all right-thinking people must accept. But Catholic Answers' own Carlo Broussard says look deeper, and you will see today's moralism is just relativism dressed up in new clothes. Carlo's eye-opening book.
This is Dr. David Anders. Are your friends or family discouraging you from becoming Catholic?
We can help on Call to Communion tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour. It's Open Forum. Tomorrow, Rose Sweet's going to be here. So that'll be fun. We haven't talked to Rose too much this summer. You can call with your questions. Right now, if you've got a question, you're welcome to call. And any question is welcome because it's Open Forum. And Jimmy Akin's the guest. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. I'm going to Chris in North Carolina now, watching on YouTube. Chris, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. In Luke chapter 17, verses 22 through 37, was Jesus talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, or was he talking about the second coming?
Well, so you just cited a passage that's rather lengthy, and normally I like to make sure we read passages so that listeners know what we're talking about. But this one is quite lengthy. I don't think I can read 15 verses here, but it is, as you say, Luke 17, verses 22 to 37. And this is a passage where, just to sample a few highlights from it, Jesus says that, you know, at just like lightning flashes, lights up the sky from one end to the other, so will the Son of Man be in his day. He's going to be crucified and stuff first, but then when the days of the Son of Man come, people are going to be eating and drinking and getting married, just like they were back in Noah's days. But then the flood came and destroyed them all, and he compares it also to the days of Lot. And he says, on that day, let him who is on the housetop with his goods in the house not come down to take any of them away. And likewise, let him who is in the field not turn back. Remember Lot's wife, because, you know, she got turned into a pillar of salt. I tell you, in that night, there will be two men in one bed. One will be taken and the other left. There will be two women grinding together. One will be taken and the other left. And they said to him, where, Lord? And he said to them, where the body is, there the eagles will be gathered together. Now, this, just reading it, you could think, okay, this this could be the second coming, but it could be something else, like the destruction of Jerusalem. And I would put it in the latter category. I think there are various lines of evidence that suggest that we're talking about the fall of Jerusalem here, not the second coming. And I say that for a few reasons. One of them is, if you look at Matthew's gospel, one of the things Matthew does is he takes material that is scattered in different places in Luke and groups it together. He organizes it. Matthew is an organizer. And he organizes material that is in different places in Luke into these big speeches that Jesus gives, like the Sermon on the Mount, that gathers together material that you find in different places elsewhere. And the same thing is true of what's known as the Olivet Discourse, which Jesus gives on the Mount of Olives. He takes Mark 13, which is all about the destruction of the temple, and that's also the same as what you find in Luke 21. That discourse is all about the destruction of the temple. And in Matthew 24 and 25, he gathers all this temple material destruction together. And then in chapter 25, he skips to the end of the world. And there's a shift in the literary style. In Matthew 24, it's much more descriptive. But when we hit Matthew 25, all of a sudden it's parables, like the sheep and the goats and the wise and foolish virgins and stuff like that. And the way it looks to me is, okay, the material that has parallels in Mark 13 and in Luke 21 is all about the destruction of the temple, and that's basically chapter 24 of Matthew. Then, when we get to chapter 25 of Matthew, we jump to the later stage of prophecy about the actual second coming. So, in pulling together the material that he does to form his version of the Olivet Discourse, where does Matthew put this passage from Luke 17? He puts it in chapter 24. So it's grouped in Matthew with the material that pertains to the destruction of the temple. So if Matthew has understood this passage correctly, and being inspired, one would assume that he has, I would say it looks like this passage should be understood as about the destruction of the temple. There's another pair. There's several reasons. The general reason that I would say that that's the best interpretation is there are clues within the text of Luke 17 itself that point in that direction. For example, when Jesus is talking about what to do in this situation, he says there's going to be this terrible thing that's going to destroy a bunch of people. And if you're on your roof, don't go down into your house to get your goods, just flee, okay? Get out of Dodge, because you need to escape this great, terrible disaster that's coming. Well, if that's the second coming, running is not going to help you. But if the terrible disaster is Romans invading your land, running will help you. You know, you need to get out before the Romans have you completely surrounded. So don't bother going and getting your goods. Just run. And that's amplified in Matthew's version, where it's like, let those who are in Judea flee. At least that's in either Matthew or Mark. So I think that is an indicator, is one indicator, that he's talking about the destruction of the temple, which will be preceded by a devastating Roman invasion. There's also another one just to mention off the top of my head, which is the final line where they ask him, where is this going to happen? And he says, where the body is, the eagles will be gathered. And the eagles were what Romans had as their standards. They were kind of totems that represented the different Roman forces. Each, like Roman legion, would have an eagle that they would have up on a stick, you know, a big pole with an eagle statue on top of it. And the eagle statue was like their mascot. You know, it represented their military might and how it led them to victory. And so it was their banner. And they would rally around their eagle statue and fight their opponents. And so it looks like Jesus here is saying, well, wherever you see the eagles, that's where the destruction is going to happen. And so that's another clue that he's talking about the Roman army. And the eagles are actually kind of interesting. At one point during the reign of Augustus, this was, if I recall correctly, about AD 10, the Roman military forces were in Germany in a place called the Teutoburg Forest. And they fought a big battle with the Germanic tribes known as the Battle of the Teutoburg Forest. We've actually, modern archaeology has dug up some of the remnants of that battle. But it was headed, the Roman forces were headed by a general named Quintilius Varus. And during the Battle of the Teutoburg Forest, the Romans got slaughtered. The Germanic tribes, they had scouts that were working for the Romans who then betrayed them and led them into an ambush, and the Romans just got slaughtered. And the Germans captured three of their eagles. And this was like a humiliating defeat for the Romans, not just to lose the battle, but to have their banners captured. And at least according to some reports, and I don't know how accurate these are, but according to some reports, Augustus would roam around the imperial palace back in Rome shouting, Quintilius Varus, where are my eagles? And they eventually got the eagles back. It took like, you know, 30, 40 years to get them all back. But by the reign of the Emperor Claudius, they actually recovered the three eagles, some of which the Germans had like put in temples to the German Hercules, meaning Thor. And by the reign of Claudius, they got all the eagles back. But that goes to show you just how associated eagles were with the Roman army as one of its symbols in the first century. And that supports the idea that when Jesus is saying where the eagles are, that's where the destruction is going to be. That's where the bodies are going to be. He's talking about destruction by the Roman army.
Chris, I'm going to leave that there so we can take our break. I hope that was helpful for you. That was a wonderful question. We appreciate it. There's lots more questions to come. Open Forum with Jimmy Akin continues on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, when we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue. Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
He was a doctor of the church, a Carmelite, and one of the most famous mystics of all time.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. John of the Cross wanted to help all Christians to become saints. One of his most important teachings was to encourage us all to learn how to love. For there is no love, he said, put love, and you will find love. He died in 1591.
To find out more about the Doctors of the Church, visit EWTN.com and click on Catholicism.
Oh. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's open forum this hour. Jerry's up next in St. Louis, Missouri, listening on 1380 AM. Jerry, thank you for the call. Go ahead, please, with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi. Yes, I've been really, really upset, and it's got me just very, very angry with the church because the defrocking of Father Frank Pavone, because all the investigative things I've done, I haven't found anything. I've heard a little segment of something that he did something sexual in his office or something. I haven't read anything about that. And usually that comes out against a priest before he's defrocked. This came out way later, and I haven't heard any evidence against it. I just think there's a liberal bastion of cardinals in our American church and throughout the world that does not want this to be the number one issue, which it should be. And I am just, well,
Jerry,
besides myself.
Yep, I get it. But do you want just a comment from Jimmy on Father Pavone, or do you have a specific question?
Yeah, what's his position about it? And, he says, couldn't control me on this.
Okay, and Jimmy, let's get. Do you have a position you'd like to share, Jimmy?
Well, I have not. I've met Father Frank Pavone, but I don't know him personally, and so I can't really comment on what he might or might not do in private because I don't know him, and I don't comment on things I don't know about. What I do know about, which is the way Jerry's question was represented by the call screener, is why was Father Frank Pavone laicized? And that is a question I could at least comment on, because the Dicastery for Clergy gave a couple of reasons why he was laicized, neither of which mentioned abortion. One was blasphemous communications on social media. And it's not 100% clear what that could mean. Obviously, I've seen speculation about what it could mean. One is that, you know, Father Frank apparently said Mass on a temporary altar, and this was one of the, it wasn't a permanent altar, so there is a question of should it be classified as just a table or an altar, but he apparently said Mass on what was effectively a temporary altar with a body of an aborted baby on the altar. And he published photos of this on social media, and some might regard that as a blasphemous act. Also, he said very harsh things about various politicians and perhaps other figures, and some of them might have been regarded as blasphemous. I don't know what exactly they were referring to, but that was the claim, blasphemous communications on social media. The other claim was persistent refusal to obey his legitimate bishop. And, you know, his bishop published a letter in which he said, it was a letter he had sent to Father Pavone sometime previously, saying, I can't work with you anymore. You're persistently disobeying my orders, and here are some of the orders you've disobeyed. And so those were the two factors that were cited by the Dicastery for Clergy in terms of why he was laicized. Okay, so that's a question I can answer. I can at least say, here's what they claimed. What I can't do is go beyond that, because I'm not privy to the private details of this situation. I only know what's been reported, and I don't know Father Frank personally, and so I can't pass judgment on his character one way or another. And so consequently, I don't really have a position on Father Pavone, because I don't know him personally and I haven't investigated the details of this case, which would be required for me to form an opinion. So if I don't know about something, I don't form an opinion about it. And I would urge Jerry to, if he's interested in this subject, to continue to research it and to research it from multiple perspectives. It's very easy for humans to fall into what's known as confirmation bias, where you have a certain impression, and your impression may have elements of truth in it, but it also, it may have elements that are mistaken. And you may reject evidence that would fit, that wouldn't fit your preferred narrative. And you may accept something just because it satisfies, you know, a narrative that you do like, oh, there's these, you know, there, Father Frank is just being persecuted because he's pro-abortion and there are liberals who don't want that to be an important issue. Well, okay, there are liberals who are pro-abortion. And, you know, that's certainly true among various people out there in the world, including some Catholics. I don't know any Catholic leaders like cardinals who are pro-abortion, but I do know that there are some who have varying opinions on how much prominence this issue should be given. And so there's an element of truth there. But that doesn't mean that that's why he was laicized. It may be easy to spin that narrative, but it also may not be factually accurate that that's why. And so we need to, rather than just go with our preferred narrative, we need to be neutral. And we need to look at matters objectively from multiple perspectives if we're going to form an opinion and see where the evidence points. It may point to a possibility, to an option that is consistent with our prior beliefs and with our preferred narratives, but it also could point somewhere else. And we need to be aware of that, because not everything that you are told is always true. Some people spin things in a way that favor themselves. In fact, virtually everyone spins things in a way that favors themselves at one time or another. That would be true as part of human nature. It would be true of Father Frank. It would be true of Father Frank's bishop. It would be true of the dicastery for bishops. That's just a human tendency. So if you really want to get to the bottom of something, you got to look at it objectively without giving priority to what we would prefer to be true, but actually taking a neutral, hard look at what the evidence and where it is and where it points.
Jerry, thank you very, very much. I do hope that was helpful for you. Thank you very, very much for the call. Just a little bit of time left and several folks still on the line. So off we go to Maryland. Daniel is in Maryland watching on YouTube. Daniel, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, guys. Thank you for taking my call. I overheard a claim from Protestant against the Deuterocanonicals that was mm-hmm. saying that Pope Gregory the Great, I think it was, rejected the Book of Maccabees as canon. Like mm-hmm. he recognized it, but he said it wasn't canon or something. I don't mm-hmm. know if that's actually true or not, or if that's just a misrepresentation. But I was just kind of wondering.
Okay. All right.
Kind of wondering what I. Not sure what the question is.
Oh, yeah. So I was just kind of wondering if that was true, that he rejected it as canon, or if that was kind of just a kind of trying to paint the deuterocanonical books in a bad light.
Well, it might be true. It's been a while since I looked up Gregory's beliefs in particular. There were varying opinions in the early church about the precise boundaries of the canon. And it would be a mistake for Catholics to insist that everybody in the early church was agreed that the Deuterocanonicals, including the two books of Maccabees, belonged in the canon. It would be equally a mistake for Protestants to make it sound like nobody in the early church believed that the Deuterocanonical books, including 1st and 2nd Maccabees, belong in the canon. Those are both misrepresentations. The truth is in the middle, as it frequently is. There were people in the early church who accepted the Deuterocanonicals, including these books, as canonical, and there were people who did not accept the Deuterocanonicals as being canonical. And competent scholars, like the Protestant scholar J.N.D. Kelly, acknowledged that the people who believed that they were canonical, they were the majority. That's why they did end up being included in the canon when the church ruled on this issue. Now, initially, it gave a series of local rulings at various councils in Rome and in North Africa that were not infallible. And so even after those councils, there were lone individuals who had different opinions. But the majority opinion going forward and even before those local councils, was that these books are canonical. And eventually, when push came to shove, after the Protestant movement started and started challenging their canonicity, the church said, okay, we need, there's a big movement questioning their canonicity now. We need to settle this infallibly. And so they infallibly defined what had been the majority position all along. That doesn't mean you can't find individuals who had other positions, and having other positions prior to the infallible definition was permitted. So so it may be the case that, like I said, I'd have to go back and check that Gregory didn't accept these books. He might have accepted other books besides Second Maccabees that were deuterocanonical. You know, he might have accepted Sirach or Tobit or whatever. I'd have to check on that too. But even if he didn't, okay, it's the opinion of one pope who wasn't teaching infallibly during a period when it was legitimate to have a diversity of opinions on this question. So I don't see it as being a huge big deal.
Daniel, again, lots of folks still on the line, so I will try to get everybody on here with Jimmy if I can. So I will leave it there. Thank you very much for the question. I'm going to a different Daniel. Daniel in Waco, Texas, listening on Red Sea Catholic Radio. Glad to have you here, Daniel. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I've been listening to a number of podcasts recently with a couple of exorcist priests, and they had said something that I've heard a number of times, and I guess I've always just taken for granted that that Satan and the demons cannot hear your thoughts, that they're good judges of character and body language and all that, but they can't hear your thoughts. Only God can hear your thoughts. And so I was thinking about that, and in regards to prayers to Our Lady and to the saints, it made me think, well, if only God can hear our thoughts, is interior prayer appropriate when we're making prayers to Our Lady or to the saints?
Oh, yeah.
Or is that only appropriate when it's to a member of the Trinity?
Okay, Jimmy.
Okay, so, yeah. The report that you heard is a common theological opinion historically. It is not a matter of church teaching. So essentially, this is a speculative opinion that demons cannot hear our thoughts. The way that medievals, including Thomas Aquinas, looked at this was they reasoned correctly. Okay, demons, they don't have ears. And they don't have physical voices. That's not part of their nature. They may be able to assume those by taking temporary human form, but it's not their nature. By nature, they're created intellects. So if angels are going to have communication with each other, it's going to have to be telepathic. It's going to be mind-to-mind contact. And so they would believe in a kind of telepathy where one angel can reveal its mind to another angel. But they were aware of a verse in the Bible that says, who can know the heart of man but God alone? And they reasoned from that, oh, only God really knows our inner thoughts. And they therefore concluded, okay, so the telepathy that demons have must be active telepathy, where you have to actively reveal your mind to another angel for that angel to know about it. But I think that's a bad inference. I think that when Scripture is talking about who knows the heart but God alone, it's not talking about angels. It's talking about people here on earth. Nobody but God can see, no human on earth can have unfettered access to your inner thoughts. And I think that's all the verse is saying. And I think that's all it requires us to say. So I think angels could have passive telepathy. Also, there's some evidence from parapsychology that humans have both active and passive telepathy. Having said that, what about mental prayer, which is what you asked principally about? Well, even if the classic theory is true, that only active telepathy exists, well, if you're praying to God, you're making your mind known actively to God, and he'd know it anyway because he has passive telepathy too. He's omniscient. And then God has the information. And so the way theologians classically explained how the saints become aware of our prayers is God tells them. God's aware of our prayers, and if a piece of information is relevant to a saint, let's say it's Saint Bernard, God will say, hey, Saint Bernard, Jimmy Akin is asking for your intercession. Here's what he wants you to pray for. And so you would let God know the information, and God would let the saint know the information. And so God would kind of serve like a router, heavenly router of prayers.
Daniel, I hope that that was helpful. Thank you very much for the question. Sorry for the folks that we didn't get to, but we do our best. Jimmy Akin has been our guest. Jimmy, thanks. I really enjoyed the 2 hours. Well, I've spent 4 hours with you today, but these two were very nice. Thank you.
Thank you.
And again, tomorrow, Rose Sweet will be here. So join us then. What else we got tomorrow, Darren? We got Rose Sweet. We know that. We'll figure it out. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.